25th, 2010. We are talking to Wendy Roberti, Al Moreno, and Sean Fahey from Claren Road. Folks, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. We very much appreciate it. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I am joined by some of my colleagues here today. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. That statute tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year, December 15th. That statute tells us to look at several things, including, one, any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance, and two, it tells us to look at the issue of too big to fail or systemically important institutions. As we discussed, I think, earlier in the week, that is one of the reasons we are looking at Lehman and one of the reasons we contacted you folks at Claren Road. We have been talking to many types of counterparties with Lehman, whether they're hedge funds, repo counterparties, folks that bought commercial paper, all those kinds of folks, clearing banks, et cetera, to see how they were managing their exposures to Lehman, and whether or not how they were managing those exposures were impacted by any belief about whether or not Lehman would fail or was too big to fail. So with that, whoever can tell us the best, can you first explain generally what your business relationships were with Lehman in the 2007-2008 time period?
Sure. This is Al Moreno speaking. Our relationship with Lehman consisted of, first and foremost, a prime brokerage relationship. They were one of two prime brokers we had for our flagship master fund. We had three agreements with Lehman related to the prime brokerage. It was a customer account agreement, prime brokerage with Lehman Brothers, Inc. There was a margin lending agreement with LBIE, and there was a global master securities lending agreement with LBIE. So those governed our prime brokerage relationships. The other relationships we had was really as a counterparty on the trading desk. We do trade primarily corporate bonds and credit default swaps. In the cash trading side of the business, we would trade with, I believe the counterparties were LBI and LBHI, and for derivatives, the counterparty, I believe, was LBSF, and backed up by LBHI. Those relationships were a lot less significant. We didn't have significant collateral balances with them, related to the derivatives, and our exposure on the cash side of the business was between trade date and settlement date versus any sort of longer-term exposure. So the real significant exposure for the firm, Claren Road, was related to the PB arrangements with LBIE and LBI.
Okay. And can you give me a ballpark of what the size of the exposure in the 07-08 time frame on the prime brokerage relationship?
We had approximately throughout from late 2007 to the end of August of 2008, you know, approximately anywhere from somewhere between 29% and 34% of the fund's NAV was with the Lehman Brothers and prime brokerage. The dollar amounts of that varied because we were growing the size of the business. At the end of August, our actual dollar amount was about a little over $1.1 billion of equity exposure to Lehman Brothers prime brokerage. By the time they filed, the insolvency date of LBIE, we had reduced that to about 20% of NAV, and the notional amount was somewhere, in excess of $670 million of equity exposure at the time of the filing of LBIE.
Mm-hmm. So understanding that you guys were growing the fund throughout 08, is it accurate to say that from late 07 through August of 08 that the equity value, the $1.1 billion equity value, that was a high point at the end of August of 08?
In terms of notional exposure, yes. In terms of percentage exposure, it was in line with the prior months.
Okay. Okay. When, if ever, well, I guess you've already indicated some. You indicated that between the end of August and the date of the bankruptcy, that you'd reduced the notional exposure from $1.1 billion to approximately $670 million. Was there any conscious effort to reduce exposure prior to that time frame?
Not significantly.
Why the reduction in exposure between the end of August and the date of the bankruptcy?
I can probably say, so this is Sean Fahey, Chris. I don't recall kind of one specific conversation, but as you gentlemen and ladies, I'm sure, well remember just kind of what, you know, where the state of the world was and also where the state of Lehman was, right, going through the summer in terms of your earnings revisions and the stock price movement, that type of thing. I think that we, you know, I don't recall specifically conversations, but I can say broadly what our thesis was that while, yes, we didn't, and I'm sure you'll come to this, so I may be jumping the gun, well, yes, we in the market were clearly surprised by the events that that transacted in mid-September. You know, we didn't think from a fiduciary standpoint it was prudent to not do anything. And so I think we were just erring to a side of conservatism, and taking imbalances and you know, moving our, you know, just kind of making the, you know, affecting the changes that we ended up making in the first, you know, first part of September. But with anything specific, not that I recall. I do, I'm, you know, one of the partners here, co-CIO here, and also the person who's responsible ultimately for all the financial positions. So I was kind of, I guess I uniquely was somewhat looking at Lehman through two prisms. A, what do I think as a partner to our firm's exposures? But B, what do you think as an investor? And yes, I mean, some of the, you know, events and comments and conference calls and et cetera that went on, it kind of became more and more disconcerting. And again, whether, you know, from a positioning standpoint, you know, that was kind of one level of thought process, but more importantly, from a fiduciary standpoint, I think we all just kind of reached a conclusion that, you know, look, there's probably nothing probably happens with this, and we're probably being overly conservative. But from a fiduciary standpoint, you have to be preservative and protect your investors' capital. And that's why we chose to, you know, to try to more right-size our footings.
Right. Thank you. What, did you guys ever have any discussions with the folks at Lehman asking, you know, guys, what's going on? You know, the scuttlebutt in the market is you know, increasing concerns, you know, particularly after you know, we've seen, at least from folks, you know, there was that September 9th announcement of the KDB deal falling through. The next day, on the 10th, before the markets open, they pre-announced 3Q08, and across the board the reaction was pretty negative to that. But were you guys having any, you know, direct conversations with Lehman, asking them about, you know, what are you guys doing? Are you going to get a transaction done? Are you going to get a merger done or anything like that?
Sean and I did not have discussions with them. Again, neither one of us was in the COO position at that point in time. I do believe our former COO may have had discussions with them, but I'm not privy to exactly what was discussed.
Mm-hmm. And I know you guys told me this when we talked earlier in the week, but remind me who the former COO was?
It was Ken Weiler, W-E-I-L-L-E-R.
Okay. When you guys were reducing your exposure from $1.1 billion to approximately $670 million, any pushback by Lehman when you guys were reducing those exposures?
I don't have knowledge of what was technically going on at that point in time. I will say that there were a significant amount of fails where we had requested securities to be transferred that did not occur in that process. You know, we attempted to, you know, accelerate the movement of assets out of Lehman midweek. I think it was around that September 10th time frame. And I believe, you know, the next several days we were you know, met with a lot of fails on those movements, which resulted in, you know, us still having, you know, 670 odd million position.
Mm-hmm. So Were you trying to eliminate all of your exposure and transfer the all of the positions in your prime brokerage account to wherever your other prime brokerage account was?
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
Well, I would just add, Chris, I mean, I don't think I'm trying to remember exactly what the conversation was. You know, when you have $1.1 billion, right, it's kind of like your thought process is, you know, let's at least move stuff and get to a more rational level first, and then I can't tell you whether there was a notion of let's get it to a more manageable number or get it to zero, but the fact that it didn't get to, you know, it would have been made sense to me at the time to say, well, let's cut it from X to 0.5X, and then if and when we get there, we can discuss whether you go from 0.5X to 0X. Mm-hmm.
Is it accurate to say that the desire to eliminate all exposure was heightened by the fact that you were having failed trades?
I think the failed trades were, to be frank, after we were trying to reduce some of the exposure, not the impetus for us seeking to reduce exposure. I don't recall exactly what happened on that Wednesday morning, but that's when we were more urgent in reducing, if not eliminating, our exposure. The fails happened afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And help
that last week before the bankruptcy.
Right.
Be clear.
Right. Thank you. And help the non-Wall Street, non-hedge fund guy. Explain to me exactly what it means when there's a failed trade. I mean, I understand that you're saying I want to move positions to another account and it didn't happen. But what specifically, how does that happen?
Well, I think it's either there's some sort of mismatch in the details between the party that's transferring the asset, in this case Lehman, and the party that would have received the assets and would have been our other prime broker at that point in time, which was Goldman Sachs, or, you know, that they could not produce said security and was failing because it might have been, you know, reapothecated or not available to be transferred.
Okay. Did you guys know, we've heard this from other prime brokerage accounts, did you know that Lehman was, could, and or was rehypothecating securities that you folks had in your prime brokerage account?
I think there might have been maybe not the clearest understanding with our agreement with LBIE to the extent that they had that right versus the similar sort of rights that are embedded in a U.S. broker dealer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, we were not receiving any sort of rehypothecation report or anything of that nature either at the time.
Okay. So when these trades fail, are you guys having any discussions with Lehman about, guys, why aren't the securities getting delivered?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that those occurred. Again, I was not a direct participant in those discussions.
Understanding that, did you hear from whoever the direct participant was about what the answer was, why they weren't getting delivered?
I don't recall hearing a response on that.
Okay. So tell me what the fallout has been for you guys in terms of the bankruptcy, since you still had 600 and I think it said 70 million in the prime brokerage account at the time of the bankruptcy, or I guess I should say, since you were LBIE, I guess I should say the insolvency proceedings, right? Since that's the London broker deal.
Yeah.
Explain to me what your experiences have been with that.
Well, I mean, obviously there is exposure that is not insignificant with respect to what we had. Spend a fair amount of time and effort, obviously, pursuing our legal rights to obtain, the maximum amounts that we're entitled to under UK and US law. It has been complicated because of the multi-jurisdictional aspect of the LBIE and LBI. It has had some burden on the firm from that perspective. There were write-downs that we have taken related to these positions that have impacted our performance, the fact that we don't have liquidity on even positions that we continue to expect to get back in the future, continues to present issues.
Mm-hmm. Have you been, I mean, have you gotten anything back out of the Libby proceeding?
Yeah, we did receive, and I think it was late June, under the claims resolution agreement, certain securities back.
Which we distributed to the investors that, holders of those.
Right.
Security.
What do you know or have an ballpark idea of what your claims are now? What you guys think you're still entitled to get back?
Yes, we do. If you just give me 1 second, let me just pull the information up on me here.
And while you're doing that, I mean, if you guys have any kind of, estimate about what kind of hit you're going to take when it's all over, I know that's tough because there's a lot of uncertainty about what you may or may not get back.
Sure. Well, right. To be clear, Chris, that estimate, that's been an ongoing process.
Right.
Right. It's not any, it's a position, so it's marked, it's rarely marked. Like any, quote unquote normal position would be.
Right.
We still believe that there are approximately $250 million worth of securities or net equity that exists at LBIE, at LBI, in LBIE's name for our benefit. So that those, are the return of those is going to be dependent upon the process that LBI has. We have an approximate unsecured claim, given all the write-downs we've taken, in excess of $300 million. The counterparties that we've made filings against include LBIE, LBI, and LBHI for those claims.
Okay. So do I take it from that the distribution that you got in late June was a relatively small distribution, given that when I add those 250 and 300 together, it's $550 million?
The distribution amount we received was a little bit more than $135 million.
Right, okay. That just about foots. And I understand values change over time because of the marks, but... Okay, so... What have been... If you can just generally, what have been the main frustrations, if any, with the insolvency proceedings? And do you have any idea about when it will be resolved, whether it's a good resolution or a bad resolution for you guys?
I mean, just think broadly speaking, the lack of clarity, particularly as it relates to the LBI process, is probably, the biggest frustration that we have.
And what is the reason for the lack of clarity in your mind? Is it? Can you explain that? Let me tell you, we've actually heard from some other folks that we've talked to that it's actually been much better dealing with the UK insolvency proceedings than dealing with the US bankruptcy proceedings. Have you guys? I don't know. You have some experience. Do you have any comment on that or any similar feelings?
We would agree with that. We have a dialogue with the administrators in the UK. They have set a process up in place that, we consented to the claims resolution agreement. And despite the, let's say more adverse legal standing we have in the UK with respect to reapplication, we did get back, securities from them. With respect to LBI, I trust this is probably what you're hearing from other folks as well. They don't want to recognize us as a direct counterparty to them. They point the finger to LBIE. So we have no dialogue with LBI.
Okay.
And also I would add that the communication coming out of London is much better. The administrators regularly attempt to advise, the creditors of what's going on, whereas you... literally a black hole with respect to the
trustee. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you? I take it you guys have made attempts to talk to the LBI folks, and do they just not return calls, or do they return calls and say?
Yeah, we have reached out to them. We obviously filed against them, and they again, in their response in court, have said that we're not a direct counterparty to them, and the filing should be against LBIE. I believe we've attempted to contact it's Hughes Hubbard that works with the SIPA trustee, and again, there's we have not had any positive response on those contacts.
Okay, I'm no bankruptcy attorney by any means, but it sounds like, and tell me if this is accurate, that the LBI is saying, look, at some point LBIE will have their claim resolved with LBI, and then you can just deal with them.
That's exactly what is going on.
Okay.
But to be clear, there doesn't appear to be any direct communication between LBIE and LBI either.
Right. Well, and that's actually, you've anticipated my next... You've actually anticipated my next question. I mean, from talking to the folks at the whatever it's called, the administrator or whatever at LBIE, have you had discussions with them about them pursuing their claim with LBI?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what are they telling you?
They're telling us that they are obviously pursuing those. They've made a filing. I think the biggest issue is the reconciliation process between LBIE and LBI has not been finalized. There was a difference in the filing dates between those two entities. One was September 15th, I believe, was the administration date of LBIE, and September 19th was the filing date of LBI that, is resulting in, I think, a fair amount of reconciliation work between LBIE and LBI that hasn't been done yet.
Okay. So we touched on it a little. You've mentioned that, you know, when you were reducing your exposure, you were doing so from a fiduciary standpoint, even though you thought, you know, something would be done. Did you guys think, you know, to use the vernacular, that Lehman was too big to fail? And that the government would do something to either provide a more orderly wind down or provide assistance to keep them open. Give me your thoughts on that, if you can.
Sure, and Chris, this is Sean again. I certainly don't recall, and it's not our nature. I mean, we usually in our business try to avoid absolutes, i.e., you know, it is too big to fail or it is not too big to fail. I think it's more kind of than, you know, again, I think it's our business, but also it's kind of our personality. We think we have a fair amount of humility as it comes to investing, and we always think in kind of probabilities, possibilities. I can just say, if you step back and say, well, forget about what you, Claire, and Rhodey even thought, what the market think. You know, the 10-year benchmark bond was trading 80. You know, they ended up obviously trading at 10 or something that next week. So it's very fair to say the market was offside on that. You know, fair value in the bond wasn't 80. They were probably trading with some kind of discount in them as to, you know, that this isn't a, you know, run-of-the-mill. But it clearly wasn't J.P. Morgan on right. September 10th or 15th or whatever it was. But I don't, you know, in terms of what we thought, I don't think we had a strong, you know, we really had a view that, sure, this could happen. Anything can always happen. And clearly that fall, and even going further back, even the bear, it was clearly a year where things that weren't really supposed to happen or had been contemplated were happening. I can say on the trading side, we didn't really have a real position. We had some positions, we had them all together for the size of the fund we were. It was, you know, extremely statistically insignificant. So really the risk that I always thought about was more of the, and yes, I think we were surprised, but I think the risk I always thought about was, well, look, I don't know if this will happen or not happen. Clearly, I didn't think it was likely to happen, but let's just get our securities, you know, get on a much better footing on the prime brokerage side and then kind of see what happens.
Right.
So I'm not sure if it answers your question, but again, it's not like we had a definitive, I think this is going to happen, this is not going to happen. And to be clear, we don't really have a position on the trading side reflecting that here.
No, I mean, tell me if this is accurate. I mean, and I'll tell you it's similar to what we've heard from other folks, but it sounds like, you know, yeah, with Lehman Brothers, you know, surprised that they went bankrupt, surprised that perhaps the government, you know, didn't do something for a more orderly wind down. But nevertheless, you know, from a fiduciary standpoint, you can't stand on that. You've got to manage your exposures in case the surprising happens.
Yeah,
Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that's how we viewed it. I mean, clearly, you know, as Albert relayed, I mean, clearly there has been on our part, you know, right and wrongly, a little bit of, you know, the only question I really have about it is, you know, the treatment of us as, or anyone as a kind of custodial, and I guess to be fair, I guess we didn't have a pure custody relationship, otherwise we wouldn't be taking these charges. But I will say the one frustration I as a partner have and someone involved in it is just the notion of, you know, am I really treated exactly the same as an unsecured bondholder per, you know, what has happened here? Again, in fairness, I guess, you know, had we done a better job knowing what our agreements were, we would understand that effectively that's, you know, what we, the position we were in.
I hear you. We've heard similar sentiments from other prime brokerage customers making the distinction between them and stockholders and unsecured creditors. Okay. Well, you know what, folks? I think you've given me the information that I wanted to. I thank you very much for your time. I will tell you what I tell everybody when we get done with these interviews. We'll look at our notes, talk amongst ourselves, and figure out if we forgot to ask you something. And if we did, I will call your lawyer back anyway. I'll call you, Wendy, but I don't think that'll be the case. Wendy, I will also have our general counsel send you the confidentiality agreement so that you'll have that for your records. And if you have questions, please feel free to call me or him after you look at that. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you, folks, for your time. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.